Not long ago, most large newspapers, magazines, and television networks sent reporters to cover wars, rebellions, and everyday life in countries around the world. With their business fragmented by the internet, few news organizations fund that kind of effort today, and we're all less informed as a result. Our next guest, H.D.S. Greenway, talks about the decades he spent as a foreign correspondent for Time, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. Over a remarkable career, he visited 96 countries from Israel to Vietnam to Afghanistan, a journey that left him with a lingering distaste for the American propensity to interfere in places we don't understand. H.D.S. Greenway on Midday After the News. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Standing by, hoping to connect with our guest scheduled for this hour, H.D.S. Greenway, the longtime foreign correspondent who's written a memoir about his years covering wars, covering civil unrest, rebellion, all kinds of stories, filed over a 30-year career for the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Time magazine, Life magazine. H.D.S. Greenway, one of the most famous bylines in journalism of the last 40 years or so, 30 years anyway. And we're hoping to connect with him. We're having some technical problems with that, but we hope to get that solved and bring you our interview with H.D.S. Greenway in this hour of the show. Well, this gives me an opportunity to tell you a little bit about our programs for the remainder of the week here on Midday. Don't always get to do this. And by the way, if you ever want to sign up for our email list, if you send us an email to midday@wypr.org, then on Sunday, no later than Monday morning, we'll send out a notice about programs for the week here on Midday for the 10 hours that we bring you Monday through Friday. Tomorrow, we're pleased to have with us Charles Blow, the New York Times columnist, who's coming into town, I think, to speak at the, if it's not the Pratt Library, then he has a book signing somewhere in town. Sorry, I'm not sure, but I believe he's supposed to be with us Tuesday and in town on Wednesday. He's written a memoir called Fire Shut Up in My Bones, Charles Blow describing in that book growing up in poverty in segregated Louisiana, including his experiences as the victim of childhood sexual abuse. And in the New York Times, he's written about everything recently concerning the NFL and Ray Rice, Adrian Peterson, the Minnesota Viking player who was accused of child abuse. He's also written about race in America, stories about poverty, columns about poverty, and about politics. So Charles Blow joining us on the show tomorrow. A neat hour tomorrow in the second hour of Midday. Earl Swift is an author and a journalist who decided to do this. This has made a fascinating story. He found an old Chevy, 57 Chevy station wagon, and traced its ownership back to when it rolled out of the GM plant in Baltimore in 1956 or 57, whenever it was built. From its time on the assembly line to through its 13 owners. Earl Swift tells the story, really the autobiography, pardon the pun, of a classic American automobile. So he's with us in the second hour of the show tomorrow. Wednesday, we continue our conversations about the nation's income gap, the concentration of wealth, and poverty with Barbara Morgan of Johns Hopkins University, Michael Reich of the University of Maryland, and Ken Solo, the founding partner of Pinnacle Advisory Group, Wealth Managers in Columbia. That trio has joined us from time to time to talk about the income gap, the wealth gap in the United States, and we continue that conversation on Wednesday. And in the second hour, there's a very provocative essay that appeared in the New Republic a couple of months ago called Don't Send Your Kids to the Ivy League. The author of that piece, a former Yale professor, will be joining us to talk about it, and we'll get some rebuttal from someone who did not agree with that professor. Also, hopefully, Kim Clark of Money Magazine joining us as well, as she's an expert on the costs and the value of higher education. A new biography of Antonin Scalia of the U.S. Supreme Court is out, and its author will be with us this week. And then on Friday, Our midday on Film Hour is devoted to David Fincher, the director, Academy Award-winning director David Fincher, whose new movie, Gone Girl, will be in release on Friday, but gives us an opportunity with our film critics, Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, to talk about the canon of work of David Fincher, who, of course, is the executive producer of the Netflix series House of Cards, which is produced here in Maryland. This is Midday. Dan Roderick's here. And we're told that HDS Greenway will be joining us after all because we solved our technical issues and have connected with him. When an ISIS militant beheaded two American journalists, the grisly murders demonstrated once again that reporting from a war zone is a dangerous occupation. Few people know this better than HDS Greenway, our next guest, who spent 30 years covering war, unrest, and chaos in hot spots ranging from Vietnam and Cambodia to India, Israel, and Afghanistan. In Southeast Asia, he survived not one but two helicopter crashes and was wounded trying to save an injured Marine, an effort that won him a Bronze Star, even though he was a civilian and increasingly skeptical about the war in Vietnam. HDS Greenway, David Greenway, worked as a foreign correspondent for a Time, the Washington Post, and then for his hometown paper, the Boston Globe, visiting 96 countries in the process, many of them at war or in great turmoil. He was in Vietnam for the fall of Saigon. He opened the Washington Post's first bureau in Israel. He reported on the birth of Bangladesh, the civil war in Lebanon, and on the demise of the Soviet Union. Mostly, he writes in his new memoir, he covered the unraveling of great colonial empires and misguided U.S. responses that involved, quote, intervening and fighting against people whose fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers fought against Europeans, telling them what to do or what they want. He has a particularly jaundiced view of our entanglement in Vietnam, where he covered the war for 8 years, along with the equally doomed efforts in Laos and Cambodia. For the U.S. military, it was an exercise in self-delusion, he writes, even for the journalists who covered it with a degree of freedom the military would never allow today. HDS Greenway says the experience often seemed unreal. From his hotel near Saigon's Opera House, he writes, quote, you could sip your drink and watch the occasional flashes of gunfire in the distance across the river while a little dance band played foxtrots from the 50s. Although he lived a life that many young journalists dreamed about, few of those who succeed him will ever get that chance. The internet and other sources have fragmented the news business to the point where few organizations now pay to support the expense and the effort that HDS Greenway's employers provided. As a result, he says, we're even less likely to understand the complex forces driving violence in places like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. HDS Greenway's new memoir is aptly titled Foreign Correspondent, and it's available from Simon & Schuster. And we're fortunate to have David Greenway with us on Midday today. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Your book describes the dangers. Let's start there. The dangers that you and your colleagues faced covering wars for half a century, most of which involved getting in the way of bullets being fired from one side or the other. But, you know, these the beheadings that I referred to, the videotape beheadings of U.S. journalists, first James Foley and then Stephen Sotloff by ISIS or ISIL militants, seems to take this danger to a new level. And I was wondering, when you were actively reporting, were journalists themselves ever the specific target of people that we were fighting or in the midst of fighting? Did journalists ever become the targets?
Not to the degree it is now. I think that in Beirut in the 80s, journalists were often captured, but nobody, remember Terry Anderson was chained to a radiator for 5 years, but they hadn't started beheading people in those days. So yes, I think it's a great deal more dangerous now. Also, in Syria, there's no one on your side. You're not going with American Marines who can look after you if you're hurt. So I think it's a much more dangerous situation for people now. And as you pointed out, so many people are freelancers now, like James Foley, and they don't have, although Global Post did their very best to try to find him and look after him, it isn't the same as having a big organization behind you all the way from the beginning.
There's a big distinction there in terms of your safety, how you travel, the support that you have as you go about doing your work. And I wonder, you know, news organizations have increasingly come to rely on the freelancers who are willing to take these risks.
Well, it's even, you know, it's a dangerous business. You have to, if you're shot in the head, it doesn't matter who, whether you work for NBC or CBS or you're a freelancer. But every conflict zone has its own rules where you can try and minimize the danger. For example, in Beirut, we tried not to move around until well after 9 o'clock, 9:30 in the morning, because kidnappers, if they were going to kidnap you, like to do it before the traffic build up in Beirut. So you didn't go out early in the morning just to minimize the risk of getting snatched off the street and being put in the back of a car and in the trunk of a car. Also, I tried to minimize the amount of time I'd spend if I went to see somebody, if I went to somebody's house or their apartment. I felt that if you could keep that to about half an hour or a little less, if somebody had an interest in selling you to the kidnappers, because that was a thriving business, you might they wouldn't be able to get organized in half an hour. So just these little tricks to minimize your danger.
I wonder where did you?
They don't always work.
They don't always work, but. That was the advice you got from what, other correspondents?
Yes.
Or there was no one handed you a guidebook when you showed up to cover these things?
Right. No, but I think people are devising these guidebooks now. I mentioned Global Post, and Charlie Sinnott, one of the founders of that, has written a little guidebook for one of his for all of his correspondents working, but. No, I would get the information from colleagues. And if I was new to an area, or if I saw someone coming in who was new, we'd all help each other out to minimize these risks.
HTS Greenway, our guest, one of the most famous bylines in my experience over the years, HTS Greenway. I'm going to refer to you as David Greenway for part of
yes.
this. Is that fine?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, when I arrived at the Baltimore Sun in the 1970s, we had foreign correspondents in, I don't know, maybe 12 different cities around the world.
And very good ones,
yep,
too.
And probably some that you knew. And, you know, that was considered to be a way to crown your career. You could work at the Baltimore Sun for your entire career if you wish to. Work your way up from street reporter, covering the city council or the county council, to the state house in Annapolis, to maybe the Washington Bureau, and then from there perhaps to Paris or Bonn or Rio, wherever the Sun assigned you. And there were other newspapers that did this as well. And now, as we know, all of that has been, not all of it, but so much of it has been rolled back, cut back, and yet we still get foreign news. You know, there's still all this information that's out there. I don't know. Maybe you can't call it all news, but
freelancers are very courageous and they do get the news, but you run into problems and difficulties. I mean, the television, for example, used to have its own film crews, its own cameramen and correspondents who would go out in the field. Now there's less of that, and television is buying film. Sometimes they can get caught when the film isn't really accurate or it's been doctored to show something that's not true. So there are dangers in this approach. And I'm not taking anything away from freelancers. Some of them are very good, and all of them are very courageous. But sometimes they haven't had the training that someone who worked their way up, as you described,
mm-hmm.
who'd had a good background at the Baltimore Sun before they were sent abroad.
Well, I guess my question is, one of my questions for you, David Greenway, is we assume that more is more, more is better, more reporters covering stories, all of that is better. Is it indeed better? The world has changed. The way news is produced, gathered, and disseminated has certainly changed. And we have fewer eyes on the news around the world, reporting on it, fewer boots on the ground, so to speak, when it comes to journalists. I'm assuming we think that's a bad thing.
Well, it doesn't have to be a bad thing, but I would say the more trained reporters you have overseas, and especially living overseas, there's nothing like living in the country you're reporting from or the area you're reporting from. For example, when I was in Southeast Asia living there, it was different than just coming into a country for a week or two and then leaving again. Or when I lived in Jerusalem, I got even in your downtime when you're not working, you're absorbing the society and the culture and their politics and their way of thinking, even when you're not working. So I think that's a missing factor now. There are fewer correspondents living in the countries they cover.
HDS Greenway is our guest in this hour of midday. His memoir is Foreign Correspondent. HDS Greenway worked as a foreign correspondent, editor for Time Magazine, The Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. He has visited 96 countries, including most of the world's hotspots during his career, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. We'll talk to him about that when we get back. A short break on midday and more with HDS Greenway after this. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, speaking with HDS Greenway, known to his friends as David. His new memoir called Foreign Correspondent tells the fascinating story of his 30-year career as correspondent and editor at the Washington Post, Time Magazine, and the Boston Globe. Most of it covering the world's hotspots, as I've mentioned. The experience left him convinced that the U.S. spent too many years bungling attempts to preserve European colonial empires at a time when colonial empires were collapsing amidst nationalist aspirations and outright rebellions. You write in the book, David Greenway, the central story of our time is America stepping into other people's empires. And as you say, generally in the empire's last days and generally on the wrong side.
Well, yes, in Vietnam, we first backed the French after World War II. And you remember Franklin Roosevelt always wanted these empires to end. But the Cold War coming and the anti-communism, the scare of communism, made America change its mind. Harry Truman changed his mind and left the French, didn't object when the French went back to Indochina, and we backed them. And then when that failed, we tried to go in ourselves. And at first we said, well, we're not going to be imperialists. We're not going to be like the French. But more and more we became like the French, especially in the perception of the Vietnamese, where we were really taking over. And in Iraq, we followed in where the British had tried to run things after World War I, and that didn't work out very well, and here we were. And then in Afghanistan, even more starkly evident, we went in where the British in 100 years hadn't been able to control Afghanistan, and nor had the Russians. But I think we went into these places without really understanding them. For example, Robert McNamara, the defense secretary for Kennedy and Johnson, one of the architects of the Vietnam War admitted afterwards that we didn't understand the Vietnamese, we didn't understand their culture and their heritage, and that he'd been all wrong. And when General Petraeus was in Afghanistan, he said, well, we don't understand the ethnic tensions and tribal differences here. So I think what we really didn't understand in our desire to confront and contain communism, that a greater force was working than the Cold War for most of the people in the Third World. And that was the anti-colonial struggle to get free from foreign and European masters telling them what to do. And I don't think we appreciated how that force trumped communism or non-communist in the minds of the countries we were trying to deal with during the Cold War.
I wonder this. When you're serving as a foreign correspondent, in this case covering the war, you're in Saigon and other places covering the war in Vietnam, how do you attain the perspective needed in order to make conclusions or come to conclusions, if that's maybe not the correct word, but just to give your reporting the scope it needs to understand what's going on in the whole country and not just to, you know, have the more narrow view delivered by the military? How did you do that?
Well, you went out in the provinces and you talked to people and you talked to Vietnamese and you went with their South Vietnamese soldiers, you went with American soldiers, and you got, then when you got back to Saigon, you were in position to see that the official briefing might not be exactly as you had seen it in the field. Mm-hmm. And that's why we call those official briefings the 5 o'clock follies, because often they were just plain wrong. And I think the great writer Sebastian Junger got it right in Afghanistan, and this would apply to Vietnam and Iraq as well. He said it wasn't that the officials were lying to you. It's just that they were inviting you to join them in a conspiracy of wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we wanted to show success. It was such a premium on making sure that everything's going well, that we officials sort of slipped into wishful thinking.
Did you ever think the Vietnam War was winnable while you were there as a reporter?
Yes, when I first got there, I said, oh, this is the right place, the right war at the right time. We're going to defend this country against communism. And but the longer I stayed there, I said, no, wait a minute, this isn't really so much about communism. It's about nationalism. It's about which side is going to be successfully putting on the coat of nationalism against foreigners. And the Ho Chi Minh was more successful in that than anybody on our side.
When you were covering the military operations of Vietnam, what was the tightest spot you were in, the toughest situation?
Well, I guess when I was shot was the toughest situation. That was in the Battle of Hue during the Tet Offensive. It was a very heavy fighting during that.
And the story about the Marine for which you were given the Bronze Star for bravery, I wondered, would you mind recounting that story for our listeners?
Well, I was going with a Marine company through the city of Hue. This was the first urban fighting that I had seen, and indeed the Marines had seen. Most of it had been in the countryside before, and there was I was sort of getting as low to the ground as I could. A lot of people were shooting, and this Marine was shot in the throat, and the Navy corpsman, who was the medical guy there for the Marines, was having trouble carrying him. So I got up to help carry him, and then when we got a little further back, some of my colleagues came, and we were carrying this fellow when a rocket-propelled grenade came and knocked us down.
And being awarded the Bronze Star for that, I can understand why the military wanted to give it to you. Did you have any mixed feelings about accepting it, being a civilian, being a journalist covering the war?
No, I didn't. I thought if the military wanted to do some recognition that for the press, that was a good thing, because there was a lot of bad feelings sometimes between the military and the press, and not on the ground level. I never had any disagreements with soldiers, private soldiers and corporals, but even captains and majors. But there was hostility at a higher level with the press, and I thought if the Marine Corps was willing to make this gesture, it might do that relationship some good.
HDS Greenway is our guest in this hour of midday on WYPR. Foreign Correspondent is the name of his book. Would you mind telling us about being out there covering the military operations, being a witness to these firefights? How did you file stories? How did you do your work? Did you have to get back to Saigon to file stories? Did the military help you in filing stories for your newspaper?
Well, what you had to do was get back to somewhere where there was at least a telephone, and you could. In those days, it seems a lot of young reporters have never seen one now, but the typewriter was how you typed up your stories, almost an antique now. And you could write up your stories and then try to give it to someone who was going back to Saigon and would bring it to the Washington Post office, or you could telephone it in. But you had to get back to where there was a telephone, and up in the north of the Marines, that usually meant going back to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And very difficult to get through on the telephone. You build up one patch with somebody putting in a plug here and a plug there to try to keep the whole thing together, and then it would collapse, and you'd have to shout in a very loud voice. And it would take you a long time to build up these networks. One time I finally got through to the office in Saigon, and I said, "It's Greenway." And they misunderstood, and they said, "No, Greenway's in Da Nang," and hung up.
You know, as you were talking about that, because I was familiar with a typewriter, too. My first newspaper job, we actually used those.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
And now you're showing your age.
Yeah, I know. I started in the Patriot Ledger newsroom in Quincy, Massachusetts.
Oh, for heaven's sake! Right,
yeah,
next
right.
door.
That's right. Yeah. So, but as you're talking about that, I'm wondering, it's a shame you're not back there. There aren't more foreign correspondents at work today because the information. Think of how you would be working today. You'd have cellular service if it was available to you, probably satellite telephones, perhaps.
Well, it's certainly easier now to get the story out.
Yeah,
that's very true. Everyone would have a sat phone now, and we spent a lot of time just trying to get the story back to Washington or wherever, and that's much easier now. And also, that is. Made the end of censorship. We used to sometimes, not in Vietnam, nothing was ever censored in Vietnam, but when I lived in Israel, for example, you were supposed to take your story to the censor before you sent it on to Washington or wherever. And if you tried to phone the story in, the line would go dead and a voice would come and said, I think you haven't gone to the censor with this. So they would listen to your telephone calls and make sure you went to the censor when you had to. Now, that's all gone now. You can't really censor the Internet the way you could censor the telephone or the telegraph. And it made it easier for me personally when the censorship was there because my teenage daughters loved to talk to their friends all the time and the phone would be tied up, and I said, "Look, you can use the phone all you like, but remember that the secret police is listening in." had a wonderful deadening effect on my daughters.
I just wanted to mention also, one of the anecdotes that you tell rings true with me, will probably ring true with almost every reporter who ever lived, because we were always told to save our notebooks, you know, if for no other reason, because we might get sued someday. we'd need them to defend ourselves in libel suits. And I have, you know, boxes and boxes of old notebooks. I have them at home. I have them in the Sun newsroom. I mean, what did you find when you went back to your old notebooks when you started writing this memoir?
Well, they would bring back memories of where I was, but the trouble is my handwriting was so illegible that I had trouble reading them.
Yeah.
So if anybody wanted to bring me to court, they could have all the notebooks. They couldn't read them, and the trouble is I can't either.
But certainly must have helped you enough to refresh some memories for the memoir.
Well, it did, yes. It did trip the memories. And then, of course, I had my clips from the newspapers. I'd saved all my clips so I could read again what I had written at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, of course, very helpful.
So, H.D.S. Greenway, what gave you the bug to be a foreign correspondent? Did you have that plan when you went to college, when you left home and went to college? How did you get into this?
Well, I got into it because I did some graduate work at Oxford, and Time magazine, as well as other papers, always used to like to have a stringer. And as you know, a stringer is somebody who's paid by the piece and not on salary or anything. A freelance, if you
mm-hmm.
will,
mm-hmm.
but someone that they could call up and say, go and talk to so-and-so and so-and-so. And I thought that was the great New York Times reporter Harrison Salisbury always said that being a reporter gives shy people an opportunity to and a reason to ask questions.
Hmm.
So I thought that this was an interesting business, and I thought to be adventurous and maybe do some good.
You know, there's some people I know who became foreign correspondents and just loved to talk about diplomacy and had an interest in the way nations negotiated with each other. There was that aspect. And then there's others who just like straight reporting, being immersed in a culture, being in a hot spot. What was it for you? What did you come to like most about it?
Well, I think all of the above.
Yeah.
I think it was. I found the hot spots and the you know what was going on the ground and talking to refugees and people in stressful situations rewarding, but also to talk to politicians and national leaders about their relationship. For example, in Israel, now this is in the 70s, long ago, I had left Israel for 10 days or so to go to Saudi Arabia. And I came back, and Shimon Peres, who was then foreign minister and just recently stepped down as president of Israel, I went to see him, and I said, look, you know, the Saudis and Israel have kind of some mutual, you know, interests here. You're both close allies of the United States. You're both nervous about the Palestinians. You're both very anti-Soviet. Couldn't there be a little cooperation, you know, under the table that you might be carrying on? And in that wonderful, deep voice, Shimon Peres said, the Saudis are like shrimp. You may like them, but there's no way you can say they are kosher. And, of course, today we have the same mutual interests. You know, Israel's scared to death of this Islamic extremism, and so is Saudi Arabia.
H.D.S. Greenway is our guest in Midday. More on the Middle East with him when we get back after this short break. H.D.S. Greenway spent 30 years covering wars and politics and political upheaval in 96 countries, from Israel to Vietnam to Afghanistan, for Time, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe, where he finished his career as editorial page editor. H.D.S. Greenway's book is Foreign Correspondent, a memoir published by Simon & Schuster. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back.
And welcome back, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for this conversation with HGS Greenway, David Greenway, his book, Foreign Correspondent, a memoir. You know, I started off the show mentioning the beheadings of two American journalists by an ISIS militant. And, of course, you follow the news and you see what our own nation, along with some other countries, have decided to do and has been doing with regard to ISIS in first Iraq and now Syria. And, you know, given your experiences and the understandings you've come to over the years about U.S. foreign policy and how we use military might, for instance, I just wonder what your reflections are on this current very complex situation.
Well, could you ever find a conflict with more contradictions? You and all being played out against this struggle between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam, which is getting like the wars between Catholics and Protestants that we had hundreds of years ago, and in Northern Ireland even more recently. But there we are. You would say that Iran would be very much opposed to this extremist group, but we can't ally with them because it would frighten the Sunnis that we want to organize to defeat ISIS, which is a Sunni organization. So that's an ally we can't use. And we're allied with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states because they are Sunni powers, and we want to show that we're not fighting Sunni Islam, but only extremists. But in many ways, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are responsible for the rise of ISIS. They have, Saudi Arabia has been exporting this Wahhabism, this extreme form of Israel, and paying for schools, these madrasas, all over the Muslim world, and they teach very extreme thoughts. And so our chief ally maybe has a lot to answer for starting ISIS in the first place. And then you could say that in Syria, if you're really serious about fighting ISIS, the one power that could do that is the government of Damascus under Assad, and yet we are dedicated to Assad going. So could you find a morass of contradictions more complicated than that?
I don't know. I mean, how do we extricate ourselves from, say, the relationship with Saudi Arabia, or do, at least, I mean, that just seems so problematic to me and has been all along. It's like we live with this contradiction. We live with a hypocrisy.
Well, I just hope that I wish the president hadn't said we're going to destroy ISIS, because we really can't destroy an idea, and we're going to have to live with extreme Islam. Hopefully, eventually, it will die away, but only the Sunnis can do that, and we can help them as much as we can, and at least this time around that we're not going in saying we're going to turn these people into Jeffersonian Democrats. We're going to instill democracy and Western values,
right,
which was always a pipe dream in Iraq and Afghanistan and even Vietnam. But we are a little more practical this time around.
How much faith do you have that we actually have a coalition that the President Obama has managed to?
It's early yet. You know, I'd like to wait and see, but I think it's a good start. But it's a coalition of support more than it is actual help, because it's going to be 95% American bombs. And whether you can do this without ground troops, who knows? And whether we want to get into another ground war in a Muslim country, I would not see much light at the end of the tunnel, as we used to say in that enterprise.
HGS Greenway opened the Washington Post's first bureau in Israel. And that, so I wanted to ask you about Israel in this picture and in terms of your writings about the U.S.'s involvement and our alliances with countries that seem to be colonial powers trying to hang on. Would you say the same about Israel?
Well, Israel's misfortune was to acquire the West Bank and Gaza just at the moment when colonialism was on the way out. Now, to be fair, Israel didn't mean to keep these territories. They always thought that maybe we can get them back, and they were waiting for the phone call, as it was said in the time, where the Arab countries would call up and say, well, okay, we'll recognize you, and we won't fight you anymore. But and then Israel would say, well, okay, the West Bank and Gaza can go back to Jordan and Egypt, respectively. But that phone call never came. And the Arabs threw their defiance in Israel's face. But then when the Arabs came around to saying, well, maybe if we went back to the 67 lines when Israel acquired the West Bank and Gaza, we'll make peace with you. But by that time, Israel found it difficult to let these territories go.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about how news is gathered by the American press overseas today versus at the peak of your career when newspapers led the way. Newspapers were highly profitable and could spend the money to support reporters such as yourself overseas.
And, well, absolutely. Yeah. I look back at it as a golden age.
Yeah. Well, I guess I wonder where are we today? What do you think today in terms of the quality of reporting and the amount of reporting you get, the number of perspectives you receive on, say, a story like ISIS or Israel and Palestine?
Well, I think everyone's doing the best they can, and I don't denigrate it by any means. But as you pointed out, people don't have the resources anymore. For example, when I went to Baghdad in 2005, the road between the airport and the city was quite dangerous. And I had the advantage of the New York Times armored car with a glasses, looked with glasses thick as my thumb, a couple of Iraqis with machine guns to guard me, and then a chase car behind me full of more bodyguards with machine guns in case my car was stopped. Now, less and less is that kind of protection from an employer possible.
But you see what I'm getting at here is if, say, you had your old job at the Boston Globe, you finished at the Boston Globe as editorial page editor. And you were reviewing the news. You were foreign editor as well. You were reviewing.
Yeah.
You were reviewing the news from day to day, and not just from your own newspaper, the Globe, but from other sources, the Times or whatever's on the internet.
Yes.
I mean, there seems, in some ways, it seems to be more information than there was in the old days at our fingertips. You may not have been able to read 30 years ago. The Baltimore Sun's account of a news story from London or anywhere instantly, as you could today on the internet.
Well, that's quite true. And nowadays, somebody who really is interested in getting the news can read any newspaper, and not only American newspapers. They can read French newspapers or British newspapers. So that's true. You do have that. But I think what would worry me is that there's less people with the background and the training necessary and the resources behind them than there were before.
Right. And a concern of mine is wondering about newspapers saying they can't afford to do this and they can't afford to do that. There has to be a will to do it, especially when we're talking about foreign news and, you know, the studies that indicate Americans aren't as interested in this type of news as they are in crime in their own neighborhoods.
Well, hopefully there's a balance. I mean, almost every broadcast and every newspaper and every television has the local news as well as the national news and the foreign news. So, you know, it's a mix. And, well, when things are going on like now, the interest in foreign news spikes. But I think there's always been an interest in foreign news.
I think so, but it does. You know what I'm saying. It does take an institutional commitment to provide. To send your own reporter to cover a story.
Well, if the Boston Globe used to have four or five well-staffed bureaus around the world, and now they have none. Yeah. Just a matter of economics. God for papers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal
and
that
the Post.
Do have people.
Yeah, and the Post. H.C.S. Greenway, I wanted to ask you this. In all of your travels, though, is sort of on a lighter note, though, but I wanted to ask you about beauty in the landscape. I was just curious about, places that you visited when you thought, my God, this is a beautiful place and there's a war going on. It's sort of a surreal moment, maybe, that you can recall.
Well, I think the whole of Vietnam was extraordinarily beautiful, and you'd be flying along in a helicopter and you just couldn't take your eyes off the scenery with these mountains that were romantically called the Annamite Cordillera, and you had the sea and the mountains next to each other, and it was just very, very striking. And even during intifadas, I always felt that there were places in Israel and Lebanon that was astonishingly beautiful, even though there was trouble going on.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for this conversation today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and all those years I've read your stories, especially in the Boston Globe, H.D.S. Greenway, and never got to speak with the man behind the byline. It was a pleasure to do so. So thank you very much, and thank you for your service.
My pleasure. Thank you.
H.D.S. Greenway's memoir is called Foreign Correspondent, a memoir published by Simon & Schuster. H.D.S. Greenway reported from 96 countries around the world. He's been, as I mentioned, a foreign editor, an editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and a contributing columnist there, and also to the Global Post and the International Herald Tribune. He was a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post and Time magazine. He spoke to us from Massachusetts. I hope you enjoyed today's program. Midday, brought to you every Monday through Friday, noon to 2 p.m. right here at WYPR. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Dan Rodericks for our staff at Midday. Hope you have an enjoyable afternoon, and we'll see you again tomorrow.